Hello, I'm Mark Ovenden on Vectis Radio FM 104.6. Welcome to Britain's only weekly FM programme about design and transport. Yep, we are chatting art, transport, communications history, that's CATCH. We call it the Catchcast. And we're hoping to get you as fascinated by our wonderful but slightly geeky subjects as myself and the excellent guests. In this edition, we're linking from one end of the country to the other, to a person whose passion for design and architecture has made his blog one of the most popular in its field. Direct from the Orkney Island to the White Island, the creator of thebeautyoftransport.com, Daniel Wright. Welcome to the Catchcast.
Thank you very much, and hello.
And thanks so much for being here, Daniel. And we're going to cover how you set up your excellent website for sure, and your community rail work, and interestingly, your direct link with the Isle of Wight Libraries, no less. But I wonder if we can start by taking you all the way back to your upbringing and ask, how did you first get fascinated by our transport and by design?
I mean, basically, it's the fault of my dad, who took me to various railway-related things. I can remember, there's a picture of me about 3 years old standing in front of Flying Scotsman at a Doncaster Open Day, I think, in probably about 1978. And we grew up in Liverpool, and we didn't have a car for a long time as children, so we used to go everywhere by bus. So I think that kind of filtered into it, this sort of idea of public transport. And the bus route into town used to go past the Liverpool tram depot, and there used to be, there was still a tram there. It's now at Crieach, and it was either under restoration or just hadn't moved there yet. But I can remember vividly seeing this tram in the old tram depot and thinking, what an interesting building it was, I guess, or just whatever childlike way you think of those things. And we used to take the ferry across the Mersey over to Birkenhead. You know, back then it was a bit more of a sort of practical ferry. It wasn't so much the tourist attraction it is today. Yeah, so basically my dad taking me on all those trips, and yeah, took me to London to go on the London Underground and various things like that.
Well done, Dad, I say. And was there a point in your childhood where you kind of noticed that you were looking at the architecture and the design of the trains and the stations perhaps a bit more than other kids, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, looking back on it now, I was like, oh, okay, this whole thing's sort of almost inevitable in a way, the path of my career, I guess. I remember going on the London Underground for the first time. Dad took me down. We'd moved to Luton by then, so we got the train to St Pancras and then went round the Circle Line. And back then, the Underground had these amazing ticket machines. So basically, there was a sort of series of fares, and they were fairly standard. And you just looked up which your station was, and then you paid the relevant fare, and you went to the right ticket machine for it. So there was like a 2p ticket, and there was a 10p ticket, or there was a 20p ticket. I can't remember the numbers.
I remember those.
Yeah, there were these big steel things with sloping tops. But what I vividly remember, and can remember to this day, and I was delighted to find one at the London Transport Museum, I think it was in the depot, their backup collection. They had these gigantic numbers on the top with the price of the fare, and they were in that London Underground Johnston Sands typeface, which is just absolutely gorgeous. I can remember vividly drawing those numbers, these tall, thin, pointy numbers that Johnston has on them school exercise books on the back cover for months and months and months afterwards. And I can remember drawing London Underground roundels, and I can remember drawing British Rail double arrow symbols. So sort of looking back on it, I was clearly interested in the design elements of the transport even then. And at the time, it didn't seem unusual or particularly interesting. It was just kind of, you don't really think about what you're interested in as being interesting or unusual or special in any way. But yeah, I think looking back on it.
But a good teacher would have maybe spotted your design leanings and perhaps fueled them a little bit. But you did actually go on to study transport, didn't you, at uni?
I did. I got some interesting advice from a careers teacher at secondary school. What I really wanted to do was be a train driver, or failing that, I wanted to work in a library. And I was told that both of those were sort of low status, not very well paid jobs, and I shouldn't do those. Of course, these days, train drivers are very well paid, and their job is recognised as being extremely important, and it's a very high status job, and rightly so. And I've ended up working in libraries as well, so I've actually sort of done that. But I went to university to study transport management, which gives you the training to kind of go and run a bus company or even a train operating company, I guess. And a number of classmates of mine are now very successfully running train companies or bus companies, or working in timetabling departments at train companies, and that's good. But I knew I didn't want to do that. But luckily, the job also qualified you as a sort of transport planner, which is the person who works at local authorities organising transport. People seem amazed that this is actually a job when you look at the state of this country's transport network, but I can only assure you it would be even worse without transport planners.
But your first job, though, after uni, Daniel, I think, was at something called the Institute of Logistics and Transport. How did you get in there, and what do they do?
It was literally just the regular thing that you do after coming out of university. You just apply for lots of different jobs as they're advertised and you wait to see what you can get, really. What they are is the professional institution for people in the logistics and transport industry. It was a proper first out of university office admin job, really. There was a great deal of photocopying and there was a great deal of minute taking and agenda sending out, because this is largely before mass email. So a lot of it was postal stuff. So there was a great deal of franking envelopes and making tea. And that was great. It was good because I got to meet lots of interesting people. And they're now the Chartered Institute of Logistics and Transport. They cover a wide range of activities. So there was, you know, there was always lots going on and sort of stuff to find out about. So yeah, it was a great job. Probably, I think it was about a year or so, because, you know, that's the first job out of university. And, yeah, then I applied for a job on a transport news magazine.
Mm-hmm. And you became a journalist.
I did. I knew I could write, and I knew I could write quickly and well. And I was one of those annoying people at university who left their thesis until slightly the last minute because I knew I could get away with it, because I knew I could write it fast over the Easter holidays, which is what I ended up doing, really, having spent a lot of years studying it. But, yeah.
In the noughties, you made a move to Surrey County Council and spent, I think, nearly a decade with them helping to improve transport planning.
I did. It's a sort of, as you can imagine, Surrey is a slightly challenging place to try and organise public transport because it's not natural public transport territory. A lot of it, it's quite rural. It's very well heeled. They used to say that a sign of poverty in Surrey was that you only had one Range Rover. but it was a good place to go and do transport planning. And those were the days before austerity as well. So we actually had modal shift targets and we had money to back it up. And of course, that all came to an end with austerity.
And then after, you were there for quite a long time, as we say, 10 years. But then after a brief return to journalism at New Transit magazine, I think it was, you came to the Isle of Wight, sir.
I did. I had basically, with austerity at the council, I had basically got fed up of transport and I left and I swore never to have anything to do with transport ever again. And that's when I ended up on the Isle of Wight, which is lovely. I love the Isle of Wight. It's absolutely brilliant. I was glad I had the opportunity to live there for a year. My other half had a year's contract on the island. And I was delighted because I'd always wanted to live on the Isle of Wight. And I ended up working for the Isle of Wight Libraries because I'd worked at Surrey Libraries after I left my transport job. And I love libraries. I think they're such a brilliant facility.
And many of our listeners who've been into Isle of Wight Libraries may well have had their books stamped by you, Daniel Wright.
It is possible. Yes, because anybody who came into the library was just so welcomed by us because we used to love our visitors. It was because libraries are so, they're one of those last great public spaces, really, where anybody is welcome. And I always thought it was an absolute privilege to meet the readers.
Oh, what a lovely way of looking at things. Bless you for that. Today we're talking with a lover and an advocate of good design in our public transport. And I understand, Daniel Wright, that you have a particular fondness for the humble footbridge. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so station footbridges are really interesting pieces of sort of design and architecture at railway stations. There's been a lot built in recent years to provide step-free access through stations, which is absolutely brilliant. And I think that programme should carry on and, if possible, go even faster. Network Rail were very aware that the design of those footbridges wasn't necessarily the most attractive visually. So they launched a competition a few years back to invite architects and designers to reimagine railway station footbridges. They ran that competition, they found a winner, and they were very kind enough to ask me if I wanted to write those all up into a book. So I wrote up the competition and a sort of history of railway station footbridges and a look at the future of where station footbridges might be going in future. And I think that probably makes me the only writer in Britain that's written a book about station footbridges.
Today's guest is Daniel Wright, the creator of one of Britain's most influential websites about transport. It's called thebeautyoftransport.com. When and why did you launch your blog website?
I launched it in 2012. Having sort of walked out of Surrey County Council as being a transport planner and swearing to myself I was never going to have anything to do with transport ever again, having got thoroughly fed up with the austerity cuts at local authorities, that lasted for about 8 weeks, I think, until I got the itch to write about transport. And, you know, I'd been a journalist and I knew I could write. What I'd always wanted was a book, sort of, you know, those books that you get that are like 1,000 buildings you must see before you die, or 1,000 cities you must go to before you die. I wanted one of those books, but for transport, and I wanted a kind of like 1,000 stations or bus stations or bridges or tunnels or something like that. And I wanted that for transport because I love all kinds of transport. And going to university and doing a transport degree is lovely because it kind of makes you multimodal. So I'm interested in aeroplane transport, and I'm interested in bus transport and railway transport and all modes, really. I got the itch and I just thought, well, if no one's going to write this book, maybe I should write it, except I'm not going to write a book. I'll do it as a website, and then that way I can just write a different thing each week of something about transport architecture or design or transport's impact on culture, and I could just do it on a weekly basis. And really, I started writing it for my dad because he'd taken me to all these places very early on that had kind of inspired me, I guess, in some way to become interested in transport architecture and design. And I thought, I'll write it for him. So I started writing an article every week or a couple of weeks, depending on how much time I had. And I started with some sort of Liverpool area ones, which I thought he'd be interested in. And it sort of started from there. And I've kept writing it. And I don't always have as much time to do it as I'd like to, because sometimes other jobs get in the way. And it is, you know, it doesn't pay anything. It's a hobby. So I sometimes have to put it on one side and do things that pay. But yeah, I continue to write it mostly for my dad. Anybody else who kind of like finds it by accident, and it's been very pleasing that a lot of other people have found it sort of slightly by accident, and they seem to enjoy it. And you know, it's lovely that it appeals to them too. But essentially, it's yeah, it's just something for my dad to read. And every time you get an article, in theory, you should see something pretty or read something interesting, and that's what I hope he gets out of it.
Oh, I hope he's enjoying it as much as the rest of us do. It's not just a collection of praise and sometimes a critical eye on design and transport, is it? You claim on the front page to cover transport's influence on art and culture.
Yeah, so I mean, transport is, you know, it touches our lives much more than we think it does, and it has been one of the great world-changing technologies. So it's sort of not surprising in a way that it's kind of seeped into culture. But you know, you can look at fine artists like Turner, who's one of his most famous paintings is Rain, Steam and Speed, which is a painting of a locomotive. Van Gogh was a great train painter. He painted quite a lot of trains, or did charcoals of trains and stations. Monet, the Impressionists painted what they saw. They didn't paint in studios. They went out, and what was around them was, you know, the development of the railways, partly. And Claude Monet was a great painter of stations and trains. He used to go down to Gare Saint-Lazare when he became famous and sort of announce himself as being, you know, Claude Monet, the famous artist, and would get the staff to rearrange the trains in the station so that it was a better composition for them to paint.
Wow.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And, you know, one of Andrew Lloyd Webber's biggest hits was Starlight Express, which was a musical about people on roller boots playing at being trains, just like we used to play at trains in the playground. You watch Kylie Minogue doing The Locomotion. I know it's a cover version, but it's surely the definitive version, which is a song all about trains. The Divine Comedy's National Express. Who would have thought you could do a big hit pop song about coach travel? I mean, it's amazing. I mean, American folk songs, a lot of those are train songs. They're songs about railway engineers. British folk music is all about sort of knights and peasants and people dying horrible deaths. And American folk songs are really about railroads because,
wow,
you know, yeah, they're the equivalent, but they're sort of the equivalent heroes, if you like, of American folk music in a lot of ways. So, yeah, it's fascinating that the way that transport and passenger transport in particular has sort of seeped into culture.
You started off an incredibly high culture with all those beautiful paintings by Turner and co. And I thought when you were going to talk about transport's influence on art and culture, you might have mentioned something like the Simpsons monorail song.
Oh, yeah. I mean, all you need to know about monorails and why they don't really work as urban transport, you can learn in sort of 22 minutes from a Simpsons episode. It is one of the great texts of transport planning, and I commend it to all transport planning students.
Now, your website doesn't just feature British transport, does it? You've got articles covering locations across the globe. Have you personally visited them all, Daniel?
I wish I had. Generally, most of the stuff that is on there is places I have been to. I've been lucky and I've been to some interesting places. A few of the American ones that are on there, I haven't. And some of the Australian ones, I haven't either. I've never made it to Australia, although I'd love to go. And I'd love to spend more time in America. You know, obviously the time I went was probably a happier time in America. But I have this dream that one day Amtrak will ask me to write the definitive book of American Amtrak stations, and they'll just pay me a sort of sum to spend the year travelling around America, taking pictures and writing up my findings of all their stations. That'd be a lovely book to do.
There were some absolutely stunning American railway stations built, but sadly, not so many of them in use anymore.
No, there are a lot that are either barely in use or not in use at all. There's a fantastic sort of Art Deco, modernist, depending how you want to describe it, station at Cincinnati, which I think gets about a train a week in terms of passenger trains. But what it mainly does is appear on films now, and I saw it in the latest Superman film. It was the headquarters of the Justice League. And I was like, no, that's Cincinnati Union Station.
Well, at least it's still getting used. I remember when I went to Detroit, the Amtrak train pulled into this. I mean, it was a station that probably would have been at home in the Norfolk Broads. It was barely even a platform. Yeah. And then just behind it was the old, stunningly beautiful Union Station. And you just think, goodness me, what a waste of such wonderful architecture. It's just such a shame.
Yeah, it has been put back into use now. It's not for railway purposes, I stress, but it has been reopened as, I think it's offices now. But yeah, at least that was restored. But there are so many beautiful sort of terminals from the sort of 20s, 30s. That are just sitting vacant. The one at Buffalo is an absolutely fantastic building, and it's just, there's a preservation group who are trying to restore it, but it's just a mammoth task.
We're still connected White to Orkney with Wright. Today we're speaking with the host of thebeautyoftransport.com, Daniel Wright. Daniel, I wonder if you get any statistics on what are the most popular subjects that people like reading about on your website?
Someone asked me this the other week, so I actually had reason to go and find out. It turns out that one of the most popular one is about the very first British Railways logos, which were two versions of a lion either on a wheel or holding a wheel, and which are lovely pieces of graphic design. Absolutely terrible if you're trying to launch a new state railway that's looking forward into the future, because both of these logos looked very much backwards. But that was quite a slightly obscure one, but that is incredibly popular, that article, for some reason. Euston's Grand Hall is read a lot. I think people search for the Euston Arch, which, to be honest, I'm not really fussed about as a piece of architecture. It's one of my unpopular opinions. The Grand Hall, I really regret the loss of, although it was sort of inevitable once you're going to rebuild Euston, and it did need rebuilding. The other one that seems to be perennially popular is the one about the Imperial Airways terminal outside Victoria Station. And it's because it's a story most people don't know. There's a big Art Deco office building which is now inhabited by the National Audit Office, but which at one point in the 1930s was an airline terminal. You checked in London, your luggage was taken away from you at that point, transported separately to the aeroplane, except your aeroplane was a flying boat at Southampton. You caught the train down there from Victoria Station, you had a special entrance from the terminal onto the station, you got a special boat train down to Southampton, and then you caught a flying boat and took off over Southampton water to far parts of the British Empire. It must have just been the most glamorous way to travel.
How wonderful. Yeah, this is the great thing, isn't it, about remembering how transport and how the whole world used to be in days gone by. There were some wonderful examples of design and architecture. Now, you've told us about how and why you started the blog, Daniel. I'm sure your dad loves it. I wonder if we can explore some of your and my favorite topics that you cover. And I have to ask you first about transport typefaces. You mentioned Johnston earlier on, but of course the more recent one is the Rail Alphabet by Margaret Calvert and Jock Kinnear. Can you tell us a bit about the history of that, how it came about?
Yeah, so in the 1960s, strangely, under Dr. Beeching, who of course has a slightly difficult reputation for closing down a third of the railway network, he also was very convinced of the need for British Railways, as was, to have a much more modern looking corporate identity. So he was an early advocate of corporate branding, and it was one of his ideas that British Rail should rebrand itself as British Rail. And it was a vast piece of industrial visual design, probably one of the biggest projects that had been done like that in the country at the time. And there were several elements to it. There were the blue and white coloured trains. There was the new logo, the double arrow, or whatever people want to call it, with the two lines and then the arrows going backwards and forwards. And the other part of it was a new typeface, which was specially designed by Margaret Calvert and Jock Kinnear. And that was used everywhere on the railway network. And it's a beautiful typeface. It does its job extremely well. It's incredibly clear. And if you are in a railway station, especially a busy one, and you are trying to navigate your way around, the last thing you need is to be tripping over the signage because you can't understand it, can't make it out. You might be in a hurry trying to get to the right platform. So it's absolutely vital that it's incredibly legible. And they spent a huge amount of time making it so. And it lasted all the way through from the 1960s right up till privatisation, well into the privatisation era, before it sort of slightly fell away when privatised train operators decided they wanted their own kind of branding and corporate identity. But it was so popular and so lodged in the memory that Network Rail recently commissioned Margaret Calvert and Henrik Kubel to design Rail Alphabet 2. which they are now hoping to roll out across the railway network nationally. They've started at the big Network Rail-owned stations. I think there's an idea that it'd be lovely if it could be extended to all railway stations, maybe under Great British Railways. But it is, it's a beautifully legible typeface, as is Rail Alphabet 2, although it's different. And it's been one of the great graphic innovations in the country, really.
Yeah, by our unsung hero, Margaret Calvert, who also, with Jock, did the lettering for our roads. So, really, they created the whole look of Britain in the 50s and 60s and 70s, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, in as much as Britain has a corporate identity, that is it. As you say, it was on the road signs. It's still in use on the government website now. It's that good. You know, no one's found anything any better, really. And they also did the typefaces for the NHS hospitals in the 1960s, which I remember vividly because my dad is a doctor. So I remember the signage from hospitals very well. And also for the British Airports Authority. Mm. So, yeah, that typeface or that family of typefaces was everywhere.
Yeah, wherever you looked, Margaret and Jock's work was there. One of my favourite design eras is Art Deco. I know it wasn't called that at the time, but there was a little subgenre of that style, which is probably the pinnacle for me. It was called Streamline Modern. I wonder if you can talk to us a bit about what the defining features of that were.
Yeah, so Streamline Modern is that really curvy kind of Art Deco that you get. If you can imagine a sort of really beautiful 1930s ocean liner but turned into a building, then that's kind of where you are. It wasn't widely used on the railway network. I've been writing another book, which I'm looking to launch sort of early next year. I was asked to collaborate on about interwar railway architecture, and it was that kind of period of time. There is some station like Hoylake on Merseyside, which is a really good example. It's got some lovely sweeping curves on that one and really nice rounded ends. You'll find it a lot on the London Underground stations where the platform waiting rooms have those beautiful sort of semicircular ends to them. Look absolutely fantastic. But even sort of some stations you might not necessarily expect. Woking Station in Surrey is actually a really good example of that sort of streamline image with its sort of like curved corners and sort of very smooth sort of look to it. But yeah, really beautiful. Yeah. Used a lot on airport terminals as well of the period. There's one at Elmden in Birmingham, which is absolutely fantastic. It has these big canopies either side, which sheltered passengers as they got on and off the aeroplanes because there were no air bridges in those days. And it's got this lovely curved front and these two huge canopies coming off the side that look like wings. Absolutely gorgeous.
And of course, one of the greatest losses in a similar style was the Southampton Ocean Terminal.
It's probably one of the great losses of that period of architecture. So it was a specialist kind of railway station at the docks in Southampton. Yeah, it had a beautiful curved front on it, which was the first thing you'd have seen as you came into Southampton. And it had lovely curved canopies on it. And it was served, so liners used to come into Southampton and you would be met by your train. It was a design that was started off in the pre-war period by the Southern Railway, which at the time owned the docks in Southampton as well. The war interrupted progress and it wasn't eventually opened until after the war, by which time British Railways sort of had the interest in the trains and the British Transport Commission, the docks. It looked exactly like what it was, which was, although it opened post-war, it looked very much like a pre-war streamlined modern building, and inside was just the most beautiful sort of curved benches and sort of scalloped ceiling patterns and sort of hidden lighting. If you can imagine the kind of cross between an ocean liner and a very high class cinema, you'll have some idea of what the interiors of it look like, but it was absolutely beautiful. And it was sort of demolished quite late in the 20th century, and I suspect that it's one of those that had it survived about 5 years more and the cruise industry had arrived at that point, you would have preserved it as being the most beautiful way to start a cruise. But sadly, just slightly fell into that gap between the liners and the takeoff of the cruise
business. I remember them knocking it down, Daniel. I was in Southampton, I saw them doing it, and we were outside protesting, saying, don't destroy this beautiful building, it's such a shame.
Yeah, we lost a few. I mean, I grew up in Hastings as well, so yeah. You'll realise by this point I moved around the country quite a lot while I was a child, but I did a lot of my later growing up in Hastings, which also had a very beautiful 1930s station by the Southern Railway, and that was also demolished in about 2004.
So
I always regret the loss of that one.
Now, I just wanted to bring you back to your own career, because you began working with the Community Rail Network in 2018. What do they do, and what do you do for them?
So they support non-profits and third sector and charities that do work at railway stations or on railway trains. So if you've gone to a station and you've found it's got a very well-tended little flower garden, or there's somebody growing vegetables there, or there's some artworks there, or someone's put up a history board about the history of the station or the town that the station's in, that will probably have been done by somebody in the community rail network, or perhaps a community rail partnership, which is they tend to work along lines, working with local communities and schools and businesses to encourage rail travel and awareness of railways. There's more than 80 now around the country doing absolutely fabulous work. And Community Rail Network's job, which I did, is to support those organisations by giving them help or advice and handing out small grants. And just what a lovely job to do, to spend time with people who volunteer their time to make their railway stations more attractive places, and then just go along and meet them, talk to them about their ideas, help them with small sums of money to get those ideas into practical reality. Yeah, super.
Well, I think we need more people like Daniel. It's been so interesting talking with a fellow railway enthusiast, a writer, a lecturer and a broadcaster as well. I hope you've enjoyed listening to him as much as I have. Thanks so much for joining us, Daniel.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you can find Daniel's website at thebeautyoftransport.com. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. We're doing more chatting art, transport, communications and history, so please do join us then.